Friends, this is Dr. Beter. Today is October 29, 1978, and this is my audio letter number 39. It was 21 years ago this month that the space age dawned for mankind. On October 4, 1957, millions around the world listened in amazement to the radio beep, beep, beep of Sputnik 1. The world's first artificial satellite was in orbit, put there by Russia. In audio letter 19, nearly 2 years ago, I revealed how it happened that Russia beat America into space. The United States could have launched an Earth satellite more than a year ahead of Sputnik 1, but our unseen rulers deliberately tied the hands of our space experts for reasons of personal gain and power. As a result, the honor of taking mankind's first step into space will belong to Russia for all the rest of human history. To one who loves America as much as I do, America's default at such an historic moment has always been a very bitter pill to swallow. And today, it's even more crushing to see that, after a brief heyday in space, America has defaulted once again to Russia. And this time, as I revealed last year in audio letter 26, it's permanent. But the history of mankind is more than the history of the United States or of Russia alone. And from a broader historical perspective, the shifting fortunes of America and Russia in space are just symptoms of far more basic currents in history. As the late great British historian Arnold Toynbee has shown, the history of man is a story of spiritual development in response to challenge after challenge. When challenges are met, there is growth. When challenges are avoided, there is crisis. And when challenges remain unmet, there is breakdown and disintegration of civilization itself. The unique challenge of the 20th century is the challenge of space. Given the hindsight of history, it was inevitable that the primary competition to meet this challenge would be between the superpowers of the 20th century, the United States and Russia. Today, this competition has been resolved in favor of Russia. And even this outcome was foreshadowed by historical clues 2 generations ago. The key that unlocked the door to space, as everyone knows, was the rocket. Invented untold centuries ago in China, it was introduced to the West by an Englishman named Congreve. But it was only as the 20th century was dawning that the significance of the rocket for space exploration was first recognized. 2 men independently conceived of rockets in this way, one a Russian, the other an American. First came the Russian, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, the father of Russian cosmonautics. As early as 1903, the year the Wright brothers flew their first airplane in America, Tsiolkovsky began publishing his writings on space rocketry. By 1913, he had already analyzed the most basic problems of rocketry and space travel, but in addition, he had given considerable attention to the psychological and spiritual aspects of putting man in space. And to this day, the Russian science of cosmonautics continues to stress these aspects of space travel far more than is the case in the West. Tsiolkovsky's speculations and calculations about space travel suffered the same fate as many other developments in Russia after 1917. The Bolshevik Revolution turned life in Russia into an existence marked by terror, hunger, and a struggle for bare survival. But meanwhile, half a world away in the United States, the other father of modern rocketry was at work. His name was Robert H. Goddard. In 1919, Goddard published his first writings on the subject of rockets. Like Tsiolkovsky, Goddard independently analyzed the earliest and most basic problems of rocketry. Meanwhile, in Russia, the great Russian famine brought on by the Bolsheviks was getting underway. Within 2 years, over 20 million Russians, the vast majority of them Christians, would die in stark terror, grinding hunger and cannibalism. Russian rocketry, along with other forms of progress, had been thrown into the ash can by the Bolsheviks. In the United States, Goddard continued his work, which, like the American space program decades later, was preoccupied with nuts and bolts more than philosophy. On March 16, 1926, Goddard made history by launching a liquid-fueled rocket 200 feet into the air from a farm at Auburn, Massachusetts. At that moment, more than 50 years ago, the United States was in a position to leave all other countries far behind in exploring the eventual prospects of space exploration. But our secret rulers of that day were not interested in anything as frivolous as the vast reaches of outer space. Instead, they were busy consolidating their own gains from World War I and the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. So Goddard's seeds of space travel fell on rocky ground here in the United States. When they began to bear fruit years later, it was not in America and not for peaceful purposes. It was in the work of German scientists at Peenemünde in their development of the V-2, the grandfather of the modern ICBM. In the Soviet Union, however, a discovery took place that was destined to lead one day to a very different perspective on space by the Russians. In 1927, the year after Goddard's historic rocket experiment here in America, a Russian scientific expedition succeeded in reaching the site of the Great Siberian Explosion of 1908. They had expected to find a giant meteor crater, but instead, they found a mysterious blast area that has absorbed Russian scientists of all types for more than 50 years. As I told you last month, these studies led some time ago to a conclusion that is accepted as fact by Russia's present-day rulers. This conclusion is that the incredible Tunguska blast was caused by the accidental explosion of a crippled alien spacecraft 70 years ago. For this and additional reasons, the Russian leaders are convinced that we are not alone in the cosmos. As a result, the Russian approach to space is motivated by long-term factors that go far beyond the narrow economic and military goals typical in the West. Just 6 days ago, on October 23, an announcement was made in Moscow which received almost no news coverage in the United States. On that day, Russian astronomer Felix Zygel of the Moscow Aviation Institute made public the Russian answer to the Tunguska riddle. Zygel described the mammoth Siberian explosion as having been caused by a, quote, extraterrestrial probe, unquote, or in other words, a UFO. By allowing this public statement to be issued, the Kremlin confirmed what I told you last month. My friends, the Russians are tackling the exploration of space as the kind of spiritual challenge that Toynbee described long ago as the key to human progress. Meanwhile, the forces of Bolshevism, which halted Russia's early researches into space travel, have now ruined America's space program. The evil forces set in motion so long ago by our unseen rulers are now leading to self-destruction. Meanwhile, Russia herself is throwing off Bolshevism, and a new era is dawning in Russia and Eastern Europe. My three topics for today are topic number one, Russia's hot pursuit of her Bolshevik enemies. Topic number two, America's panic rearmament leading to national suicide. And topic number three, the public signs of war to come. Topic number one, increasingly these days, I am asked the same question over and over again. And that is, quote, if the Russians are after the Bolsheviks, why should they kill so many of the rest of us? After all, we haven't done them any harm. In fact, they are getting everything they want, so why go to war? Unquote. My friends, I've tried to explain these things over the past several months, and yet I do understand the confusion it is causing among some people. Many have not been aware of the vast international power wielded by the Bolsheviks, who disguise themselves in many ways. Those who do know about this satanic power have the opposite problem. They are tempted to think that the Bolsheviks are all-powerful, and therefore that Russia could not have freed herself from the Bolshevik grip. But the simple fact is, my friends, that things do change. In spite of the enormous power of the Bolsheviks, they have been overthrown in Russia. As I said in detail last month, this did not take place in a sudden overnight coup d'etat. It was accomplished over a period of 6 decades of tireless struggle by the self-styled spiritual communists who now run the Kremlin. The spiritual communists, unlike the Bolsheviks, are a native religious sect, a Christian sect, which began in Russia over 2 centuries ago. Today, they are abandoning communism in everything but name, but in their religion, they remain perhaps the toughest and most tightly knit group on earth. Having learned the hard way, they view Bolshevism as a totally satanic system without any redeeming features. And after 60 years of struggle that dwarfs anything experienced in the West, they regard the Bolsheviks themselves as less than human. Today they regard the United States as hopelessly infected with the disease of Bolshevism, and therefore they intend to destroy the United States as they would a rabid dog. I have mentioned this rabid dog viewpoint of the Kremlin before, but there is another way in which they view their holy war against the Bolsheviks that is rooted in nothing less than international law. It is the doctrine of hot pursuit. The hot pursuit concept can be illustrated by thinking of a police chase of fugitives. Suppose, for example, that a police car sets out in pursuit of a getaway car, driven by thugs who have just robbed a store and murdered the owner. Even if the getaway car should race across the city line into another jurisdiction, it is accepted practice in general for the police car to continue the chase, regardless of where it leads. The reason is that the police are in hot pursuit of the fugitives for a crime committed within their jurisdiction. Today, the rulers of Russia see themselves as the police, and the Bolsheviks as the murdering thugs who are fleeing from justice. In the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, the Bolsheviks robbed Russia of her riches and murdered the owners by the millions. Now, after a struggle of 6 decades, the spiritual communists have turned the tables on the Bolshevik outlaws, who are leaving Russia in a growing torrent. They are seeking sanctuary mainly in the United States, where they are joining with the Bolshevik elements already here in a new Bolshevik revolution. The Bolsheviks plan to throw America and the West into nuclear war against Russia. So Russia's rulers are fighting fire with fire. Soon, their hot pursuit of the Bolsheviks will rain nuclear devastation on our heads. The Russian rulers are aware of the argument that we non-Bolsheviks of America have done Russia no harm and therefore should not suffer with the Bolsheviks. But, my friends, I must report to you that this argument, reasonable though it sounds on the surface, draws nothing but scorn within the Kremlin. No harm, they say? Then why, they ask, are we giving unquestioning sanctuary to the floods of Bolsheviks now leaving Russia? And for that matter, they add, how can a people who won't lift a finger to save their own land, America, be counted as friends by anyone else? No, they conclude, you Americans are refusing to recognize what is taking place before your very eyes. It is a takeover by the Bolsheviks, and soon you will wish you were dead. By comparison, they say, Russia's nuclear attack on the Bolsheviks among you will be merciful. The Kremlin is carefully keeping track of the new Bolshevik revolution now underway in the United States. It's more sophisticated now than it was 60 years ago in Russia, but the Russians know what to watch for. And the progress of this secret and quiet revolution is one of the indicators that are being used by Russian intelligence to gauge the time left to prepare for war. A key factor in the American Bolshevik Revolution is the economic turmoil now building up. Central to all of this is the collapse of the United States dollar. Over 5 years ago, I described in detail the whole plan to collapse the dollar deliberately. That was the subject of my 1973 book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, published by George Braziller, 1 Park Avenue, New York, 10016. And gold If today's gold price is measured not in the United States dollars, but in hard currencies such as the German D-mark, the true value of gold will be accurately reflected. But earlier this month, I was in Europe and saw for myself just how far the collapse of the dollar has already gone. I've been to Europe innumerable times over the years, but this time I had a new experience. Many shopkeepers will not accept American dollars, whereas they used to be eagerly accepted. And where dollars are accepted, they will buy very little. The so-called almighty dollar is almighty no more. And so, my friends, the dollar is losing its international role. It is becoming a garrison dollar, a currency which will still buy a few things here, but will soon be almost useless outside the United States. Already, the federal government is preparing for a reverse split of the dollar, just as was done in the recent past in France. In this way, all old dollars will be forced out of hiding. The process of our economic imprisonment is advancing rapidly, and most Americans are still blissfully unaware of it. The so-called voluntary wage and price guidelines announced by Jimmy Carter 5 days ago will be replaced by mandatory controls in preparation for war. By the end of this year, 1978, I'm informed that all non-corporate Americans will be virtually blocked from transferring funds abroad. Part of it will be done in the name of protecting our economy and safeguarding our national security. But one of the real purposes is to serve the Bolshevik Revolution by closing and bolting the prison gates around America through your pocketbook. As the Russian rulers watch, they see the Bolshevik plan progressing right on track. Soon, economic turbulence will be joined by political turmoil. And a little later on, there will be shortages, hunger, rioting, terrorism. And as America descends into the hell of Bolshevism, there will be cannibalism in America. Even now, our own secret rulers have reactivated the weather control grids around America, which I first revealed last May in audio letter 34. From September 24 through October 19, they were shut down for reasons related to the autumn equinox. But on October 20, just 9 days ago, they were turned on again, and they are once again being used to modify our weather. As a result, strange weather can be expected periodically from now on through this winter. Through every avenue imaginable, the Bolsheviks are marshaling their forces to attack, undermine, and if possible, destroy Russia. And to borrow the words used by Alexander Solzhenitsyn in his speech at Harvard last June, quote, "The fight for our planet, physical and spiritual, a fight of cosmic proportions, is not a vague matter of the future. It has already started," unquote. 2 months ago, I warned about the sinister developments that were being set in motion within the Roman Catholic Church. I said that the Bolsheviks want to use the Church as a weapon in their war against Russia by maneuvering the Church into an anti-Russian stance under the guise of anti-communism. By doing so, they expect to enlist 700 million Roman Catholics, one-sixth of the human race, into their own battle to the death with Russia. When I recorded audio letter 37 2 months ago, Albino Cardinal Luciani of Venice had just become Pope John Paul I. He quickly became known as the Smiling Pope, yet he left the scene after barely a month's time. As I said last month, the Bolshevik game plan was going to be tried again with another new pope, and that is happening now. The new pope was elected earlier this month on October 16. Instantly, his image as an anti-communist was seized upon by the American news media. And even the name he has taken, Pope John Paul II, signifies a second try in the Bolshevik game plan I revealed in August. Pope John Paul II is the first non-Italian pope in 455 years. Carol Cardinal Wojtyła of Poland. During World War II, Wojtyła was a member of the Polish underground, which fought against the Russian and German occupation forces. For 30 years as a church official, he has challenged and struggled against Poland's Russian-dominated regimes. And just last month, on Sunday, September 17, he played a key role in firing the opening gun of the Roman Catholic Church against Russia. On that day, a pastoral letter spearheaded by Cardinals Wyszynski and Wojtyła and signed by all bishops was read in Catholic services throughout Poland. Poland is the most heavily Roman Catholic of all countries in the Russian orbit, with over 14,000 churches and an estimated 85 to 90% of the population Roman Catholic. What's more, the Poles have a natural hatred for Russia as Big Brother. So it caused no small concern in both Warsaw and Moscow when the pastoral letter was read to Catholic congregations throughout Poland a month ago. The letter, whose contents reached practically the entire population of Poland, blasted government censorship as, quote, paralyzing the cultural and religious life of the nation, unquote. My friends, the image of the new pope is that of one who stands up to the Russians. But the way in which this image is to be used is another matter. And I think it is essential that both Catholics and non-Catholics alike know what is going on behind the scenes. For at this very moment, the church is becoming both tool and target of the forces of Bolshevism. If what they are doing is not stopped, the Catholic Church will soon be destroyed. What I am about to reveal, my friends, gives me no pleasure at all. I myself was born a Roman Catholic. I was raised a Catholic. I even studied for the priesthood. For me personally, though, there still were unanswered questions. It was only later in the bush in Africa that I truly found our Lord Jesus Christ. But I speak as one who knows what it is to be a Catholic. And my purpose is to help and to build up, not to attack or tear down anything that is good and right. Even if the things I am about to reveal should lead to scandal, I must agree with the words of the wise priest who recently counseled me, quote, "It is better that scandal should come than for the truth to be suppressed," unquote. If the truth does remain suppressed, my friends, the days are numbered for the organized Roman Catholic Church, and there will be repercussions throughout all of Christendom. 2 months ago, one of the briefest papal conclaves in history ended in a surprise election. Cardinal Luciani of Venice became Pope John Paul I. His election had been masterminded without his knowledge by a Bolshevik faction within the Vatican. It was thought that because he was a complete outsider to the Vatican power structure, he would be the ideal puppet pope, easily misled and maneuvered. Within weeks, while the world was still getting acquainted with this man called the Smiling Pope, the Wyszynski-Wojtyła pastoral letter was issued in Poland. But Pope John Paul I was turning out to be a disastrous choice by the Bolshevik manipulators. They were failing in their efforts to have him pose a flinty challenge to Russia under the guise of anti-communism. Instead, he was preoccupied with people and how the church might best serve them, including the people of Russia. My friends, the stakes are high and the time is short, and the consequences for Pope John Paul I and for Catholics everywhere were tragic. He had been elected to an office he had neither expected nor wanted, and his reaction had been strangely prophetic. As reported by Newsweek for October 9, 1978, Pope John Paul I had been stunned at his election, and he had said to the other cardinals, quote, "What you have done to me, may God forgive you," unquote. It was almost an echo of the words of our Lord Jesus Christ nearly 2,000 years ago. As he hung dying on the cross, he said, quote, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do," unquote. I must now reveal that during the night of Thursday, September 28, 1978, Pope John Paul I left the Vatican alive. He did not die in his sleep that night, as reported by Vatican sources. He lived for 3 more weeks incognito away from the Vatican before finally being shot in the back of his neck by person or persons unknown. On October 4th, the funeral for Pope John Paul I was attended by tens of thousands of mourners and witnessed by television viewers in 31 countries. The body that lay in state was not that of Pope John Paul I, who was still alive. But as everyone knows who has ever lost a loved one, a lifeless body never looks the same as a living person had looked. And so, thanks to the mortician's art, no one questioned that the remains on view were those of Pope John Paul I. After that, even if he himself had walked into a church somewhere and announced, "I am the Pope," quote unquote, he would not have been believed. After all, people had seen the funeral on television, and they had read about it all in the newspapers. Pope John Paul I was still alive on October 16th, the day that his successor, Pope John Paul II, was elected. Since there cannot be two popes at the same time, this raises a thorny question. Was the current pope legally elected? In any case, the man known briefly as the Smiling Pope was put to death the evening of October 19, 1978, 3 days after his successor was named. Shortly thereafter, his body was cremated and the ashes disposed of. My friends, nothing will ever be seen again of the late Pope John Paul I, and no evidence has come to light that would enable his assassins to be identified. Nevertheless, not all of the evidence of his tragic fate has been destroyed. I refer to the body that now occupies the sarcophagus of Pope John Paul I in St. Peter's Basilica. The body is not that of the Pope John Paul I. It should be exhumed, not only for an autopsy, but for scientific identification procedures under independent supervision. If this is done, it will reveal the terrible fraud that now threatens the very soul of the Church. If it is not done, the Bolsheviks will have won already in their grasping to manipulate every Catholic on earth for war. In that event, the Church will be used in the cause of Bolshevik warfare against a Russia that is becoming a Christian nation once again.